But the Academy right now is trying to keep up with.
Yeah, because it's
for
the
example,
Academy.
Like Black Twitter.
Yes.
Yeah. Why can't This Is America?
It's rigid.
Why can't Lemonade? Why can't all of these? Like, if you.
Every rule should actually have a critical lens, because so many of these rules are actually chains and bars and locks on our progress. The problem is holding to whiteness. Like, to me, the thing that's hard to say, and I'm going to say it right now.
Do it.
And it might mean that no one ever listens to this podcast. So we're recording. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, and welcome to People Have Color. This is a new podcast, and I am your host, Corinne Mills. And my guest today is Rachel Stein. Rachel, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm a woman. I am 36 years old. I finished my PhD in Latin American and Iberian cultures last year. I'm finishing out a year of teaching Spanish at Columbia. And I'm about to move to New Orleans in a month, where I'm going to become a research and instruction librarian at the Latin American Library at Tulane University. So that's going to be a totally different career.
Yeah.
I mean, adjacent and related, but new career as a librarian.
Okay.
And yeah, I'm married. I have a baby. 2 years old.
Congratulations. Yeah. Thanks for Thank sharing you. Your age.
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting question. Like, who are you? Where do you start?
I was just thinking, well, the idea is to ask my guests to introduce themselves, to frame their own identity for the audience, because the idea of the show is to talk about identity in new ways. So I don't want to make any assumptions around the way people identify. Yeah, I don't want to make any assumptions about how you see yourself. And I think that's part of it, is to helping people stop make those assumptions.
Yeah, it's interesting. I remember, because we're doing the Evite for a going away party, and then I was looking at our prior Evites, and the last one was my daughter's 1 year birthday party, which was also folded into my dissertation completion graduation party. And it said, the title was, Joni's won and mom's dissertation is done. And one of my friends from school wrote me and said, that's so weird that you called yourself mom in the third person. And that's when you ask to identify, that's just become such a central new label of my identity.
It only took a year to start referring to yourself in the third person as mom. Probably took less than that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. So yeah,
same here. Four years in over here. So yeah. I'm Corinne. I'll introduce myself again. I'm the host, Corinne Mills. And I currently identify as a hustler. I'm newly working for myself as part of living my best life. And it's a struggle as a mom to be hustling for work, to be newly embarking on a different stage, a different frame for your career. Self-defined, self-activated, propelling myself. That's part of what this podcast is, part of living my best life. And I also identify as a Black woman, a mom, and a wife, American, and the youngest of two children.
Yeah, I guess I would add that being an identical twin is a big part of my identity. It's interesting. It's about to become a much bigger part of my identity again.
Yeah.
Because we're going to be living in the same place. Whereas here, it's been like, since she's been gone for the past 6 years, it just hasn't been as much of a thing.
Wow, 6 years.
Yeah, I think it's been 6 years. Even though people still stop me and are like, literally on Saturday at the Brooklyn Museum, a woman said, hi, I know you're not Laura, but I know your sister. And I also spotted you at the Botanic Gardens earlier today.
Well, I guess you guys have been twins longer than you've been apart for 6 years.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But that'll be an interesting new, not new, but renewed additional stage thing of
being together.
Yeah.
Yeah, as adults.
Yeah.
Yeah, because your lives have really grown and developed apart in these last 6 years.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I also always wear glasses now, so I think that'll
that's a change.
Somehow that happened. I don't know. My eyes just stopped wanting to wear contacts.
Oh my gosh, mine too. I was looking to put one of these sticky tattoos on my son, the kind that, you know, like a race car tattoo with water, and I have not, I'm not super well practiced in it, so I had to look at the directions and I swear I pulled out a magnifying glass to read these directions. I felt absurd.
I've had horrible eyesight since second grade, but since pregnancy, my eyes got really dry.
Wow.
And it never got better.
Got dry.
Dry. That's why, yeah.
Like from strain?
I have no idea.
Huh. And with the glasses, keep your eyes moist?
Well, no, but the contacts feel like it's like sand scratching on my eyes, so I just have to wear glasses. And another thing I found very interesting, since we are both women and identify as, well, I said I identify as such anyway.
Yeah, I did too.
I know you do, but I didn't know if that was like a central thing. But the eye doctor said most or many women experience chronic dry eyes and they just don't know why.
Huh.
And that's just one of those many things about being a woman. It's like, of course, diseases. Yeah. And like the ailments that afflict women are not well studied. Whereas maybe if men were the ones who had chronic dry eye.
The magical, mystical condition of being a woman. Yeah. Who knows what it's all about? Okay, so today, on today's episode, you and I, Rachel, we've talked about a couple of things that are on our minds. I wanted to just ask you what's on your mind, and I'll just say what's on mine first, and then I'll ask you to chime in about what's on yours. So today, really, what's going on is the Donald Glover video.
Yes.
This is America. It's what's going on for America right now, and American pop culture. My Twitter.
Yeah, mine too.
And, you know, I just thought there's not enough being said, so we should say more.
We're going to have so much to add.
Yeah, it's not that there's not enough being said. It's just that it's going on, so it's on my mind. And I do have a couple of things I'd like to mention about it. Also, my phone addiction, which is related to my consumption of the Donald Glover video and opinions about it. Mm-hmm. And feeling stuck in my bubble around everything that's consuming my brain. I mean, this hustler lifestyle of mine of making my own work does keep me isolated to an extent, which brings me to the content that you shared with me that was on your mind. And I want to ask you, you know, what your thoughts about it were, because you sent me some stuff to think about to talk today, and I consumed both of those things.
Okay.
I read the James Baldwin article last night, and I listened to the Code Switch episode today, both of which were about navigating a Jewish identity in the context of, you know, American civil rights and American identity, and like just the sense of like Jews as a marginalized group,
right?
And what does that mean today, and what are just some ideas around that? So why did that come up for you? Does it relate to anything current?
I don't know. I mean, I've told you before, I consume a lot of podcasts because I have a long commute.
I do need
several days a week. And so, So, and I'm especially been really into podcasts that have to do with race.
Okay, so me too. So it's not just me. Well, you're confirming my bubble to an extent because you're in it with me. You're in my Facebook world. But
I think part of, and this related to something I want to talk to you about Twitter and when to speak on Twitter and what to say, especially as a white woman who only identifies as white because I know that I belong to that socially constructed category, yet I don't think that whiteness is something that actually there's nothing cultural that I feel identified with, and I don't know it means.
Can we really get into it? Because I have so many thoughts about that. But that's that's in a nutshell, that sort of meandering way of describing it is how I feel about it. It is this vague thing because it's constructed. What is it? The more you try to pinpoint it, the more elusive it is.
I mean, it seems like it has to do with power and acknowledging that you have that as a white person, I have
power
and privilege. But there isn't anything like music wise or like what the things that we normally identify as cultural. I don't know what that means for there to be a white culture unless it's like country music, maybe.
I don't know why. Like, maybe people will get that, but Beyonce's Lemonade album showed me, you know, reminded me that there are Black Texans.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Texas owns country music, but
right.
You know, even that falls apart upon scrutiny.
Totally.
There's a majority to it. There is a cultural thing. So let me just say my point of view about it is that, if I can, is that everything is cultural. Culture is what exists. Race is the construct we put on culture.
Yes.
And on a system of power. It's a way that we organize power to be a trick. That's what I see race as. Otherwise, all we have are cultures, and culture is real. But it's hard to delineate in clear, sharp lines the way that we try to delineate race, because we share so much culture across race.
Yeah, I was talking to my sister about this the other day because she founded a dance studio that's largely, they offer hip hop. She and I have both taught hip hop dance in the past. And we're thinking about like, why were we drawn to this art form that's not, supposedly not ours? And we could very, you know, rightly, I guess, be accused of cultural appropriation as being white people who took on, just said, okay, I can teach that.
Yeah.
I love that. I connect with this. And I can't get out of the commercial matrix that I live in. We grew up.
Well, it's the culture mix that a lot.
Fifth grade.
Yes.
I memorized every word to Baby Got Back.
Yeah.
All of those things, like that consumer culture defined me growing up. And that was where I started loving R&B and hip hop. Mm-hmm. So then it's like,
is it authentic? Is it okay?
Right. Yeah.
Of course it is, because who is anyone to tell you you're wrong for living the life that you've led and enjoying and consuming the art that you have and it having had whatever effect it's had on you? The things that feel wrong are abuses of power.
Yeah.
And that is caught up and tangled up in the way that we consume and experience culture because of these real tangible things around like struggle, around people making a life for themselves. That's the cost. Those are the consequences and the stakes of an abuse of power, is the struggle that it requires and the threat to people's safety and security. But those are conflated with like this lived experience of disempowerment, of seeing yourself like, you know, I'm talking a little bit vague and heady, but I'm consumed right now with this experience and this dialogue that I'm seeing on social media around like appropriation and this real anger from people of color, Black people that you see around feeling like things get taken from us all the time. And that to me is an expression of disempowerment. Of, you know, there was this thing on Facebook the other day around Vogue highlighting like long nails or something, like nail art, and feeling like that was appropriating. And it is, but only in the sense that Vogue is more powerful than you. And there are ways that it is, but it's not all powerful. It gets power from us. And just the engaging in a discussion that says you are more powerful than me and I resent you is propping up its power it's inauthentic power, the inauthentic power that it holds over you that's unfair. And I'm not saying like the people who are angry are at fault for that. I'm just saying like that's the paradigm shift, is that the discussion, the way you think about it, the things we believe around power are the problem and also changeable. That's the trick of it, is that we believe these things, these stories, the rhetoric and the beliefs are as huge a piece of it as the police officer's foot on your neck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the question, I do have had a sense in recent years, since like Black Lives Matter, since all of us, or at least in our bubble, many of us have been thinking more about it, or I should just speak for myself, I've been thinking more about it, mm-hmm. like has caused a hyper awareness of race and issues of race that I didn't have before, which is so important. But it also feels, to use a super academic-y term, like reifying, mm-hmm. in a way what you're saying, like by repeating this discourse.
Yeah.
Both the dominant discourse and the resistance discourse.
Yes. They're almost like two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. And so what's the next step?
It's actually questioning. I was watching a TED Talk in preparation for some work this week. And this woman was saying, she was a conflict expert, a specialist in conflict, has a master's degree in conflict resolution, and said one of the major keys to conflict resolution is to promote curiosity, to preserve and practice curiosity. That's the key to openness, to an open-minded approach, to taking in new information.
With how to move past.
To me, it just opened up. It's not about, one person having the answer. It's about breaking up our assumptions, questioning your assumptions, naming assumptions as a condition of our oppression, is that we assume things. Like, I'm sorry, I want to keep this thing short, but I have so many thoughts.
I don't need to keep it short.
I have so many about that are bubbling in my head around. I also recently watched a documentary about lions.
Okay.
And I can't stop thinking about it because it was so brutal. Like, lions are so beautiful and they're so powerful, and they're these free animals that you want, like, to preserve their freedom, where they really do exist in the safari, not in the zoo.
Right.
But they are brutal. They don't have justice.
Mm.
And my brain was just firing on all these analogies between lions and humans, just as beasts. Mm-hmm. Like the men. Not the men, they're lions. The male lions, mm-hmm. are really brutal. They're more dangerous than the females and the children, obviously. They will hurt and maybe kill the mom for interfering too much with their food, which the mom most likely caught for them, tracked down. The moms do the majority of the hunting.
Oh my goodness.
And they won't as easily hurt their own children. So the moms send their kids in to get the food. And I just, as a mom,
oh my God.
I just had a lot of thoughts about that.
And also, I'm sorry, can I just jump in with
that?
Because that makes me think also that so much of like what masculinity means, mm-hmm. in our society is propped up on centuries of scientific examination,
yes.
of animal behaviors,
yes.
and justifying human,
yes.
behaviors on perceived animal behaviors.
Yes.
So it's like, whatever's natural or not natural, people, mm-hmm. have historically looked to animals to,
yes.
determine.
Well, that's what I'm doing presently, actually, is looking to animals.
Right, but that's... No, but, I mean, on the one hand, it's like you see the parallels. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, then it makes me think, well, is that innate to humans as beasts,
well,
too?
You know,
or
what,
is it that humans have used those kinds of observations
as
a justification to act? Yeah.
Yeah, for our own shortcomings.
Right.
And inabilities to evolve socially. That's interesting. It feels cynical, but I'm here for it as well. I'm here to listen to that. My thinking about it right now is that that's why we're so hung up. That's why it is hard to evolve, is because we are also animals. The thing that separates us from lions is our ability to evolve socially, is our ability to create new systems and structures and to carry information in ways that animals can't. We have history. Animals have the yearly cycle, basically, and that's it. And that's what I learned from my own master's studies in media, is this great like demarcation between man and beast when literacy started to take hold in human societies, when people started to do markings and to start to create symbols rather than just physical reality. And literacy is the great break in man from beasts, in my understanding and interpretation.
Representation.
Yeah, I'm sure there's like tons of academics. Like I'm a pseudo intellectual in this way, where I have deep thoughts, but also deep suspicions around any institution as a historically marginalized, oppressed identity, as a Black American. I just distrust the academy and all really like formalized Western institutions, European institutions, because they were not made with my identity in mind.
I think what's really interesting about the current moment too is that for me, the most interesting and groundbreaking and boundary pushing intellectual work is being done outside the academy.
Yes.
And I'm saying this coming from someone who's just been at Columbia for like 8 years. You know?
It's the thing that people do, is to seek higher learning. And it's gotten more and more sophisticated over the years and centuries, because people, it's a human need, is to seek higher learning.
But the academy right now is trying to keep up with,
because it's,
for example,
academy,
like Black Twitter.
Yes, because the academy is actually a fully open-ended thing. It is what the people in it make it, but it's also,
yeah, but the people who are in it are,
yes, it's also steeped in the tradition of hierarchy, of white supremacy,
of
patriarchy and white supremacy. And those institutions have their own very strict and specific culture that we never name. It's men, white men, it's suits, it's a certain diction, it's a certain cadence, it's a certain tone of voice and a sound to your ear and a look to your face that allows you to discredit other things as not serious, as not, you know, important, not to be taken seriously, not to be listened to the same. But for example, and we all conform to those things and use those things as like standard measures.
I want to bring this back in connection to Donald Glover.
Yeah.
Because the first thing I thought when I watched that video, the This Is America video, was this is why the humanities matter.
Yeah.
This is why the discipline, why these disciplines matter, and why art matters.
And actually, the truth of it is that it has always been forged by a more diverse, full humanity than it's represented by.
And Columbia and all these institutions, the humanities are under attack, yada, 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 all this stuff about the human. And it's true. They are under attack.
Yeah.
But why are you holding on to, it has to be Greek tragedies
that's why it's
that
under
are
attack.
The core. Yeah. Why can't This Is America?
It's rigid.
Why can't Lemonade? Why can't all of these? Like, if you make students understand that that's human expression and the study of human expression is the humanities.
Yeah.
Then to me, the discipline has relevance.
It is relevant. It has to, you know, it will continue to evolve. Whether you know Columbia University keeps up with it is its own thing, but it will continue because people will continue to be smarter and smarter.
And
theoretically
go up against institutions. Like you were saying, I mean that's what the real.
But yeah, but like I mean, I talk to people all the time who, in shorthand, just say burn it down. Like that's the next step, is burn it down. So in what ways are we burning it down? When you think about that, it's just about like questioning everything that you assume, every rule should actually have a critical lens, because so many of these rules are actually chains and bars and locks on our progress.
Yeah.
I don't know where I'm going with that, but
that's what but to me that's what the humanities need to do, and yeah. That's what I've been thinking about too.
I mean, the only thing I guess I'll say about the Donald Glover thing, I think I can keep it short, is the Donald Glover video is everybody, there was so many articles written about it overnight and so many analyses to wade through, and it felt overwhelming and exhausting to me as a consumer of these ideas, as someone who's really interested in these kinds of ideas. And also the, I think the exhaustion was around like just really wanting to do this podcast, wanting to actually like speak in my own words, and also just so tired of the structure of a final answer, the main like paradigm that needs to shift of binary thinking. Mm-hmm. Of right and wrong. There's a right answer to actually what this video means. Mm-hmm. There's a single answer. This definitely means this. This symbol definitely means this. And the thing that is fascinating to me about media and that really engaged me when I pursued my master's is that media content is a two-way street. There's the person who creates it, and then there's the audience that consumes it, and the audience adds at least as much to what the thing means. Mm-hmm. as the creator does. The meaning happens after it's created.
Yep.
The final story of it happens after it's created, once it's consumed. So this video, like, I've just heard so many like the people trying to hate on it just to have a different take. And because people are also exhausted by being kept in these like yes and no boxes. Mm-hmm. There is a spectrum to everything. It doesn't, none of these analyses like are the final word. They exist because what was supposed to happen happened. Something hugely provocative.
Mm-hmm.
Hit. And it like all of the events around it mattered. The fact that it was Donald Glover, who was doing this groundbreaking show on cable, and occupies this space as an artist that you take seriously in a certain way in the culture. So people took his video seriously, or the people who were already following him took it seriously enough to spread it through their own word of mouth in a way that it like caught virally. The people who write these kinds of articles,
mm-hmm,
are the audience for this kind of video. So that's also another sort of tailwind that this thing had to propel it forward into the zeitgeist. And everybody having a reaction or feeling like they have to have a say about it means that it's successful regardless of what the takeaway is. And we are make the meaning. It does matter what the meaning is, but like the power of making that meaning is with us. It's not with having the right answer about what Donald Glover meant.
Totally. I agree with that 100%. Yeah. One thing that I saw, one Twitter, like, critique that I saw was, like, I'm exhausted with all these, this discussion of black male genius,
mm-hmm,
with the Kanye versus.
That's an very interesting discussion sparked by this,
yeah,
moment. Yes, I'm here for that discussion.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I thought that the Beychella event, mm-hmm, got a lot of attention.
It did
too, but I don't know if it was I think it was, who was it? It was Brittany Luce. She has a podcast that I listen to, The Nod.
Oh, I love that podcast. Yeah. I did not know her name.
Yeah. She was the one who made that comment. Yeah. And then I was like, huh, was Beyonce being referred to as a genius? Because her point was like that word genius.
Yeah. I don't think so. I don't think they use that word for Beyonce. That wasn't my takeaway from Beychella. It's just that, like, she's excellent is what I hear about Beyonce is the takeaway I get from her. She is excellent, high performing, but I don't think people give her, like, genius credit at all. No. I have way more to say about that, actually, as a new convert to the Church of Beyonce.
Yes.
A reluctant convert to the Church of Beyonce. That's a whole other episode.
Beyonce and genius.
Is Beyonce a genius on the next people have color.
Because watching that HBO documentary made me really, it was hard.
Yeah, that was well before I was converted.
Yeah.
That made me feel
it makes me validated feel
and not following, not being a convert, not being in the beehive. That damn HBO documentary.
The other thing I was thinking about the Donald Glover video is, what could a white artist do that would be so provocative or stirring?
Woke?
What? Not even woke. Like, what could they do that would be so... What do white people have to say about society?
Or about society, their own point of view about society.
I just was thinking about
I mean, like, Eminem did it. Like, do you remember Eminem put out a song about Trump? It really didn't hit.
I did not see that.
It was months ago, and it was really good. I mean, Eminem's a super talented MC.
Yeah.
Sure. I'm sure people feel different ways about it, but I thought it was brilliant writing. And I bet you a lot of people heard about it. Like, my take on Eminem actually is that everything he does is huge. I just don't follow it. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But it makes me think about something you and I talked about, like, months ago with the I Am Not Your Negro documentary and the one quote.
And I would love to talk about this Baldwin essay, which was so amazing. I pulled several quotes from it.
Yeah.
But okay. Keep going.
When Baldwin says the race, I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember the exact quote. The race problem is not a black problem. It's an American problem.
Yes.
And like, I don't think.
That's the paradigm shift. Like, that's a shake up in the way we talk about it.
I don't think that white people see how it's a problem for us
themselves.
I will group myself, you know, and I think
the problem is holding to whiteness. Like, to me, the thing that's hard to say, and I'm going to say it right now,
do it.
And it might mean that no one ever listens to this podcast, is that what has to happen is to let go of the white identity. Whiteness as an identity is strictly, to me, the core meaning of a white identity is the oppression of others, because almost no one on earth can identify as white.
And acknowledging that staying on top may equal the oppression of others. Because
like,
I don't think
very core to that identity is the idea of hierarchy.
Yeah.
And disempowerment of others. Of conserving power. Because even white people, the patriarchy, the man, the Illuminati, oppress other white people. The breakthrough I had in thinking about this about a year ago, I was after watching 13th. This is what I got from 13th. And I wish I could remember the quote that sparked it. But my main takeaway from that is that the trick of this whole system is to preserve power and resources for the few. They don't actually have to be white. They just have to be few so that the resources and the power can grow exponentially, like, without bounds. You cannot have a system like that where, like, with excesses like that, if people are equal. The idea is not that, it's not race pride. It's not, like, these people who have everything, if you believe in a conspiracy, which I don't actually, a conspiracy at the top. I just think it's this thing that happens based on these structures that we've all built over time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not race pride that keeps, you know, the 1% dwindling to the 0.5% to the 0.01%. It's this beast-like, brutal, patriarchal dominance that's about exclusion. That's a thing that people do, like, when we don't evolve socially, which is to continue to exclude. Like, every person on earth, we're constantly talking about a human needs to be free. Everyone always resists their oppression. And we don't, you know, people talk about slaves don't get credit for how much they resisted every day. And oppressed people don't get credit for the ways that they just always resist their oppression. Native Americans refuse to be slaves, that kind of thing. But that's true. People always do resist their oppression because people do yearn to be free, because beasts are free, to bring it back to lions. Right. But beasts don't have justice. That's the other thing that fucks us up.
is that we want to be free, but we interpret freedom as including fairness.
Mm-hmm.
And this like yearn to not just to be free, but to be realized, to be fulfilled, to be seen, to, you know, have enough. Like, these are like higher things, as far as I understand them. They're not our nature. They're our evolution. And that's why it's a struggle. In a nutshell. I think.
It's just so many things to
think
about. Because with the problem is so many white people, yeah, including white liberals,
yeah,
don't see themselves as clinging to
a white identity
of that's oppression.
That's the trick of it, is that we all believe that, right, this whiteness exists. That's the trick of it. Like, the arty metaphor for it is the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was, from The Usual Suspects, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was convincing the world he exists. Whiteness actually doesn't exist.
Right.
But we all believe in it. Believe that this there's this real thing to a human identity, when really, you know, what is whiteness? Is it a culture? Is it a race? It's a race, right? What does that mean to be white when it excludes 90% of humans? There are no lines around that. It's just a system of exclusion.
But how can
whiteness is its own
how
bubble.
Can white people feel attacked by the system in the way that non-white people do? That to me is the, like, how can white people be brought into consciousness,
yeah,
of the nefarious effects on them?
On them.
Be, I maybe, don't know. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's because I see it as like, oh, those poor everyone else.
Yeah.
That's why race.
You know what it was that clicked for me in that Baldwin documentary, though, is like all those images, and this was the filmmaker, of, yes, like the 50s commercials. Yeah. Is that, you know, it's the myth of America, which is what Baldwin writes actually very clearly and regularly about. It's a myth, and people are actually, everyone, white or otherwise, are living desperate lives of struggle. And the thing that people who identify as white cling to, and you tell me if this is wrong because I don't identify as white, is that is that there's the possibility, mm-hmm, of this peaceful life without struggle,
mm,
that like ideal whiteness has achieved, and it doesn't actually exist. You know, yeah, there is happiness. Yeah. We all can buy a new car. We can't all
but
buy a
also
new car.
But
lots of people can buy a new car and feel like they're getting a little bit happier, right, or more secure or settled. But it doesn't replace, I mean, it doesn't eliminate the threat of, you know, sudden death, which every human faces.
Right. But I think it might be the failure to achieve that myth,
yes,
that causes a lot of mental illness.
Yes.
In white communities causes a lot,
like that's what angst is. That's what existential angst is about. Is about pretend, reckoning with reality versus pretend. And like whiteness is so much about pretending something that doesn't exist.
Because I think about those images from the documentary a lot too, and thinking, yeah, about that's why white people who aren't doing well, who aren't well off, mm-hmm, financially, are so angry.
Which is most Americans.
Yeah.
Like,
of no, course. Yeah.
I mean, that's my New York bubble as well. But most New Yorkers are struggling as well. Yeah. This is the richest city in the world with like the wealthiest people in the world. But that's a very far from the majority of people in this town who are struggling to make it work and to achieve some this myth of ideal living that's unattainable.
Mm-hmm.
Like if we're so uncomfortable with reality, if like, is there a way to get comfortable with living a real life that would disempower the patriarchy?
But we're so individualistic,
yeah,
and everyone's out for themselves in such a way that it just seems like it'll never. People are not willing to give up the little what they have.
Yeah.
You know, like, well, and that is so related to the school issue. Yeah.
The whole thing.
Yeah. But that is so related to, like, mm-hmm. the public school issue.
Yep.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Like, that is, like, the main...
That's, like, the trickle down
is
of all this.
White people trying to keep schools segregated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because we know in our gut beastly selves that there is a difference in the quality when the schools are segregated.
Of course.
Period. Yeah.
I mean, and that's what I'm...
And we believe it. We believe that if we integrate the schools... that you're doing worse for the white students and better for the black students.
Exactly.
That's a belief.
That's a social,
cultural belief that comes from.
I mean, so Tulane has an agreement with
I missed the add-on. That comes from generations of living under the construct of race.
Yes, and that in this way I feel very white mm-hmm. in this arena, for mm-hmm. example, if we're defining race as we have been and acknowledging it for what it is, like, so talking about schools and pre-K and all that stuff. So my job at Tulane comes with a perk
mm-hmm.
which is Tulane has an agreement with a magnet school. It's a public school mm-hmm. in New Orleans that apparently is quite racially diverse. Mm. I don't know how economically diverse it is. And 50% of their kindergarten class is reserved for students of Tulane children of Tulane employees. Mm. And so, of course, the instinct is like, oh, that's such an amazing perk. We need to jump on that for our daughter. Mm-hmm. We need to get her into that school. Yep. Of course, my parents who... I mean, my parents who, you know, they raised me in
any assumptions about your parents.
They raised me. I was raised in a very much upper middle class suburb of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
Went to great public schools that were like very well financed by the tax dollars mm-hmm. of the very wealthy community that I lived in. And for them, it's like, of course you would send.
Yeah.
You better send our granddaughter
to the best possible school.
But then Matt is going to be, sorry, teaching maybe I shouldn't say his name. My husband
is going to be teaching at not the best school. Yeah.
And
like, why should
we are invested in, like, we are philosophically and morally invested in improving the education system.
I'm with you. I am not white and I share this. Like, I read something on Facebook a year or two ago. All of our information comes from Facebook. Yeah. Just this really hardcore, like, you're right to feel guilty about abandoning your public school. Don't abandon your public schools. Like, we need right. everybody should be in the public schools. And it was compelling to me. This person was saying, I'm an activist. I can't call myself an activist if I'm sending my kid to private school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was compelling to me, except not enough to sacrifice my kid.
Well, that's the thing. Have you been reading Nicole Hannah Jones's she wrote a bunch of pieces for the New York Times about this.
Yeah.
She's like my Bible for this. Like, I've been reading. So she did those This American Life episodes
uh-huh.
that are all about segregation, uh-huh. like how school segregation.
I'm feeling overwhelmed by just learning about current day segregation. I know it through osmosis, not through like actually reading about it.
She breaks it down like... It was an awakening for me to read
mm-hmm.
the way and listen to her on This American Life too, the way she breaks it down. And it's like, it's not even private versus public. Mm-hmm. It's parents in Brooklyn all trying to get their kids into the specific public
mm-hmm.
school
mm-hmm.
that's zoned whatever to get out of the public school that's down the block from them.
Yep. I just went through this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she talks about this. She's like, she has a child and yeah. she her big New York Times Magazine piece about this was, of course, we all want the best for our child. Mm-hmm. And that's why,
obviously, we want the best.
That's
for
why
our child.
She's pessimistic about it, that it will never change.
Yes.
Because, but of course, I want the best for my child.
Because it's a symptom of another issue. Like, this is not the place where you fix systemic racism. This is the byproduct of systemic racism. Mm-hmm. Like, this is where the rubber meets the road with systemic racism. This is what you get from systemic racism, is a segregated public school system that's intractable. This is what you get from pretending that whiteness is founded in just identity pride. It's not. It's a system of power. It's a human system of organization and power and limiting resources for people.
But that's the, to me, that's the question as a white person.
Yeah.
Shouldn't I be like, whatever this woman who you read said, like putting my money where my mouth is or whatever the expression is. I'm horrible with those kinds of expressions, but like, shouldn't I be sending my, the problem in New Orleans, of course, is that it's all charterized and it's not even districted. So it's not like there's a school we're not choosing.
I'm starting to feel clear in this conversation just from what I just said that came to me, is that no, I mean, I'm always looking at like, how are the masses behaving? Like, I believe in the wisdom of crowds, and that that's one of my beliefs, is that you can't just dismiss what people do. You can talk about it, and like, the another thing that we do that doesn't get us anywhere is blame and shame, which is a byproduct of like binary thinking and you know, not being involved. And people are going to continue to do this, like you were saying. This woman says, like, this is this thing that people, that's not going to change because people want the best for their kids,
right?
That's, people want, people will, being willing to do whatever to protect their children is not going to change,
right?
That's not going to change. And their behaviors around that are based on their response to the inputs they're getting. Like, that's the animal part of us that can't change. People have to secure themselves before they can do anything else. You cannot have extracurriculars if you're fearing for your life, right? Mm-hmm. To put it in extreme terms. And people, like, defending their children, that's just, that's so primal, it can't change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's why it reflects the other things that we've done that we do have other control over and like more flexibility in. Not that it's really easy to change like the things at the top, but just this.
Right. Well, that's, but then when you say that, my next thinking of the next step I always go to, always with all these issues, is, well, the government needs to force people to do what's right in some way.
Needs, I mean, like, the not government the government, needs to, but put, schools need more equal funding.
Yeah.
They need more equal tax-based funding than they get in New York City. I don't know all the details. I don't want to go super deep into this, but this is the richest country on earth. We do have the resources to fund a decent education for every citizen.
For sure.
Period.
I mean, I was thinking about it today with all the teacher strikes. It's like, shouldn't there be a law that public school teachers, whatever the like mark for middle class or comfortable middle class or whatever, shouldn't teachers be required to make that salary? And shouldn't schools have a bare minimum? You know, I mean, how is this not
like those required are the
by
shoulds.
Our government?
Yeah, those are the shoulds.
Yeah.
It's just, we should structure ourselves in ways to support each other. We should share our resources in a way where people don't have to worry that they don't have enough food for their children.
So what did you guys, I would like to hear. I know I've been talking for a while.
So you asked me about what we're doing with our son.
Yeah.
And I just don't know, because I went through the stressful pre-K application process through the Department of Education. They make it as stress-free as possible when you're dealing with a public as large as the public in New York looking for a school for their kid. You know, I do truly believe that that system is doing the best it can as far as this the way this lottery system works. There is the districting, but each school has a little bit of their own process. Some schools do zone, some schools don't. The number one school on our list just goes by district. Like, you have the highest chance of getting in if you're in the district. You actually have the highest chance of getting in if you're in the district with a sibling who goes to school and you're on financial assistance, some sort of financial subsidies, because they reserve 60% of their spots for kids that are in need, and 40% for kids that don't qualify for aid.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the preference for siblings within the district. So we were a family that did not need aid, that did not have a kid already at the school who had been to the school, but we do live in the district. And my own research pointed me to it to be the first school on our list, because I'm looking for a progressive model. If I were to choose a private school, it would be Montessori or Waldorf, which is, I've looked at both of those in Brooklyn.
Right.
There's like 10 Montessoris in Brooklyn. Yeah. There's one Brooklyn Waldorf school, which I absolutely adore. It's in a really incredibly gorgeous building. Plug for Brooklyn Waldorf. Just so beautiful. And maddening that, like, a school experience like that in a beautiful space with, you know, not crowded classrooms, just the experience of being in that environment, regardless of what the teaching is like, has an effect on your child.
Right.
Has an effect on you. And it's just not readily available. Then there's like the prohibitive cost of tuition of a private school education. Most people in New York can't afford it. A friend of mine pointed out that all of these, you know, gentrifying Fort Greeners mm-hmm. that live on these beautiful streets that I can no longer afford, even though my first apartment was there,
mm-hmm.
are sending their kids to public school because everybody's faking the funk that they're like a wealthy New Yorker. Very few people are wealthy New Yorkers.
I would love to see how many people are getting help from family.
There are so many people trying to gentrify these schools and make these schools better because they can't afford private school.
Right.
And it's caught up in, you know, segregation, politics, and all of that. But most of us are trying to make it work with free education because we do believe as Americans we're entitled to it. That's a part of our Americanness that most of us share, is the mm-hmm. belief that we should be entitled to a decent free education. Why should you have to pay when most people don't make a decent enough wage for that to possibly be reasonable?
Right.
So, and other countries seem to manage to figure this out. So all of that in my head, trying to figure out what to do with my precious angel's education, because he is my beautiful, precious gift, which is the daycare he attended along with your child. Yes. Just a reminder. I mean, like, that little rinky-dink daycare really took care of us. And shout out to Precious Gifts, which left me with this metaphor a reminder that my child is my precious gift.
Mm.
I regularly use that expression. He is my precious gift. And I want to do right by him. I feel a huge sense of responsibility to make sure my precious gift gets everything he deserves, because it's my fault he's here. And he lives in a world that does not have his back in lots of ways. You know, and I believe that your beliefs inform your experience. So I do try to stay conscious of assumptions and everything that I've been preaching here around assumptions,
mm-hmm.
that I have to believe in my own power and my son's power for him to have it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm his first example and role model of that stuff. And he's going to get a lot of his beliefs from me.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I believe that like, you know, just being in the practice of this is giving him a better chance. And I just also believe that I need to surround him with advocates and limit the amount of people who are going to be blocks to his growth, people who are going to put him in a box that he doesn't belong in.
Yeah.
And I just know too many stories, my own story of being like an elementary public school kid from New York City, from Brooklyn, New York, and how rigid the experience is, and how easy it is to get lost, not to mention, you know, what you hear nowadays all the time around the, you know, the school to prison pipeline, and how teachers, you know, reinforce these toxic ideas of race and patriarchy to our kids despite their best intentions. They do it. The fact that black males in the school system get penalized more often, just period, just get less benefit of the doubt and more punishment than anyone else, just because that's the reality we live in. And my son is a black child. He's a black male child that's about to enter into institutions. He's going to cross the barrier away from me into these institutions. And it's incredibly fraught for me to make the best choice. I'm certainly not going to sacrifice my son to the cause of bettering the schools. I'm just not.
Yeah,
I believe he has a better chance at bettering the schools if he grows up believing in his own power rather than fighting the system the whole way. I know that there's value in the fight, and that having me as his advocate is a huge piece of the puzzle. But I also know, you know, that we're just one story in the world, and my own story is of being an incredibly late bloomer to self-empowerment. Incredibly late. I know that I'm a woman, and that's a part of it, and I identify as a Black American woman, and I do believe that those identities are a part of it, just in terms of everything I've just been talking about. But there's also so much personal experience and personal history that's at play there. And because of whatever circumstances, I didn't have the advocate that I know I can be for my child. And I want to see what happens when somebody has your back in that way, to part the waters for you in a way that just didn't happen for me. I do want to see how far my child can go when he has some advantages that I didn't. And that's a common thing, I think.
It's so interesting because I'm like, our situation's almost reverse in a way. I don't think about worrying about with my like privileged white upbringing. I don't think about that.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I want my son to not think about his value in a given context. I want it to just be part of the the ether. I don't want it to be part of the calculation. I want him to start in front of that valuing of himself. I want that valuing to be taken for granted, that he doesn't have to prove it or establish it or confirm it for himself, that it's just there. That changes the way you enter a room and the space you take up when you stand in that room.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
You should just do monologue podcast episode talking about your child, because that was amazing.
Thanks. Okay, I'll think about it.
Yeah, because we could do a whole nother show about what I'm actually, it's probably a to be continued.
Yeah.
What will it be like when the three of us are planning ourselves in New Orleans, which is a totally foreign city to us, in the middle of a over 92% Black neighborhood?
Mm-hmm. That'll be really interesting. We will have to do a follow-up.
Yeah. Like, yeah, it'll be, I don't know how long we'll live in this house that we've bought there, but for sure, for the time we're there, that's going to be such a different experience for Joni than what I had growing up.
Yeah.
And Matt and I.
Yeah.
Both grew up in the suburbs, upper middle class. So similar upbringings, both of us. And she's going to be in the middle of a city. She's going to be definitely on our block, the only white kid. A few blocks down, there are other white kids, but on our block from the people we met, only white kid. So I am, some ways I feel like we're putting her through an experiment or something.
Well, maybe you can talk to my husband, my white Jewish husband from Atlanta.
Yeah.
Who grew up with a little bit of what you're talking about Joni is going to have in her young childhood.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, that is interesting.
Yeah.
To be continued.
Well, thank you for this. This was great. This is the kind of conversation I'm hoping to have, and I hope someone is interested in listening to.
Me too. If not, I just fulfill my dream of being on a podcast. Yeah. Even if this doesn't make the cut, I enjoyed it. So.
No, this is definitely making the cut. This is coming out. Okay. So thank you. There's so many more things I want to talk about, but I do also believe wholeheartedly in brevity.
Yes.
Which
that's what editing is for.
Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks, Grin.
Thanks for joining me.
Yeah.
Onward.
Awesome. Yes.
Bye.